Okay. And of course, we weren't going to get going without Judge Smith. So, all right, we will begin. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is September 13th, and we are hearing oral arguments via the Zoom platform. I am joined for this argument by Judges Werke and Smith. And the case we are about to hear is the fourth case on our oral argument calendar today, A220449, City of Minneapolis Relator versus Thomas R. And I'm going to mispronounce this, so please correct me right when I do. Thomas Tichich. How do you pronounce his name, Ms. Behrman?
That was perfect, Your Honor.
Okay, good. Respondent and Public Employees Retirement Association of Minnesota respondent. So thank you for joining us via Zoom today. This was originally scheduled to be an in-person argument. I do thank you for your flexibility this morning. We wanted to make sure that we could have everyone join us for the argument. Now, counsel, I'm sure you're quite familiar with the timing requirements, but I will briefly cover them with you before we jump into your arguments. The appellant will have 15 minutes and the respondent will have 15 minutes and appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. We will be keeping track of the time remaining in your arguments on screen with a clock. And I just want to make sure you can just nod. Can you both see the clock on the screen? Okay. We are recording this argument, and in order to make sure that the quality of our recording, it's an audio recording, is acceptable, I just ask that you remain in mute when you are not actively presenting your case. Before you begin, please introduce yourself and identify the party you are representing. The recording of the argument in this case will be available a little later on the court's website. That concludes my remarks. Counsel, are you ready to go? Okay, then we will begin with counsel for appellant. You may begin.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Heather Robertson, and I represent the relator, City of Minneapolis, in this case. Your Honors, in this case, the respondent has been awarded benefits by the Public Employee Retirement Association. That respondent is not legally entitled to receive. Specifically, he was awarded duty disability benefits, which triggered the city's responsibility to pay continuing health insurance coverage under Minnesota Statute 299A.465. The city got a contested review of that decision and had a contested evidentiary hearing in front of an administrative law judge at the Office of Administrative Hearings. Here, the ALJ, when reviewing the findings of PARA, made administrative findings that were affected by an error of law and that were made upon improper procedure. Specifically, when the ALJ found that in reviewing PARA's duty disability determination, that it did not matter that PARA had failed to follow the statutorily required procedures to determine if an applicant qualified for duty disability. This error affected the City of Minneapolis's substantial rights because it leaves the city's taxpayers on the hook to pay the health insurance of an individual who should never have been approved for duty disability if PARA had followed the procedure and statutes applicable in this case. The statutes at issue are sort of a Russian doll of in statutes referring to other statutes, referring to other statutes. Starting at the top, we have to look at Minnesota statute.
Let me just jump in there at the very beginning as we're beginning to dive into the statutes. Do you believe that the statutes that control here are ambiguous as to, you know, whether things are procedures or standards, or as to any other matter required to determine whether there was a duty disability?
I do not believe that the statutes are ambiguous. I believe that just reading the plain language of the statutes, it is clear what is required by PARA and clear that PARA did not meet those requirements in this case.
Can you tell me, Ms. Robertson, procedurally, in this is a simplistic question, but, you know, so he petitions for disability, petitions for duty disability benefits, and it goes in front of the ALJ, and the ALJ says, gee, I can't do anything, I'm limited by statute. But you had 3-day hearings, so there was a lot of information and evidence presented. Is the evidence sufficient, the testimony that was taken, that in the event this court would agree and reverse or remand this matter, that the ALJ could make a decision? Or where does this go as far as opening a record? I'm trying to figure out this whole thing. Can there be a determination as to regular disability? How does that work, if you'd explain it to the panel?
Well, my position is that the findings of the administrative law judge in this case, if the correct law were applied here, are actually sufficient for a straight out reversal without having to remand for any further factual findings. The findings that she made, which I listed in detail on pages 3-7 of my reply brief, all support the conclusion that respondent should not have been awarded duty disability benefits at all. First, because his disability arose more than 2 years before he applied for duty disability benefits. Second, because the duties expected to be performed by the employer 90 days before his last day were purely administrative duties in the traffic investigation unit. And third, respondent was capable of performing those specific duties in the traffic investigation unit, despite any diagnosis of PTSD or symptoms of PTSD.
Let me ask the you findings about that of the administrative. I'm sorry to interrupt for a second. So, and I know we need to get into law. That's a big thing about the what the ALJ did legally. But as I understand it, there's a procedure that measures your abilities against your duties under the 4A and 4B in a regular disability, duty disability benefits determination. And then the question is under the sub 4A and 4B, what you're measuring against relative to when the application is and the date of injury, right? And so your argument, I think, is that the date is that we should be looking at the last 90 days of service to measure ability to perform against those.
And, that is correct.
Right? Okay. And before we get into whether that's right or wrong, I wanted to understand, say we agreed with you. Did the ALJ find that he was able, that the relator was able to perform the duties within that were in the last 90 days of his service?
While the ALJ did not make that, didn't use that phrase, that sentence, that he was, respondent was capable of performing the duties, she made many factual findings that could not support any other conclusion. I mean, she found that his duties were purely administrative. He wasn't assigned to any duties that, you know, would have exposed him to traumatic events. That his supervisor was pleased with his performance. He had no performance issues. He didn't have, you know, sick days. He didn't have days where he couldn't come in. He reported to his psychologist or his therapist that he was able to keep working. And so it's my position.
Okay, so you're saying that we should infer from those factual findings, a factual finding that he in fact could perform the duties of that job, that that's a necessary inference from those other factual findings. Say we disagreed with that and it had to, and again, I'm positing that we agree with the legal analysis, but we haven't arrived obviously at even that discussion of that yet. What if there were a remand on the question of, okay, ALJ, you need to determine when that date of injury is, and or let's even accept your argument that the ALJ has already decided when the date of injury was, and that it's measured against the last 90 days of service. Then I think we get into the argument, for me at least, or the question of what does the ALJ look at for that? I mean, part of this is you're saying, well, to para, he didn't prove X. And then, of course, he's saying, well, you guys didn't supply what you needed to para to decide X. What does the ALJ do? Just look at fresh evidence around all of that and decide what PARA should have decided with respect to the capability of performing the duties?
Yes, the ALJ is capable of, the ALJ's review is not a sort of error review of PARA. The ALJ reviews and is able to accept facts that were not available to PARA at the time PARA made its decision. And so the ALJ has to decide whether PARA erred in awarding duty disability. And so that as a matter of fact, not as a matter of what PARA had available to it. And so the review that the ALJ does is based on not just what PARA reviewed, but upon all of the information that is produced in the process of bringing this contested evidentiary hearing before the ALJ. New information can be considered.
Okay, so you could end up with a result then that an ALJ decides that it should not, that it's not, there is not a duty disability, and so there's no health insurance, even though disability benefits are continuing via another process, right?
Yes.
Okay.
You need to turn to these statutes. I actually am going to ask a question about the statutes, hopefully that will give you an opportunity to dive into them. So with regard to 353.031 subdivision 4, which has an A and a B and sets forth procedures, is it your position that though that subdivision and those two provisions in A and B are substantive or merely procedural?
It would be my position that they are substantive requirements. But even if they were only procedural requirements, that is a sufficient basis for reversing this decision, because under Minnesota Statute 14.69, a decision that was made upon improper procedure alone would be a basis for reversal. But this statute 353.031 is called the procedure that PARA must use in assessing applications, but it has a combination of substantive and procedural requirements. For example, one of the requirements is that the application must be submitted within 18 months of stopping work. Otherwise, you can't get benefits at all. Even if you were to meet the definition of duty disability, if you don't get your application in on time, you are not entitled to get benefits. So by that same token, if the application isn't supported by the evidence required by 4A and 4B or 4B, depending on the timing of the application, regarding whether the applicant is able to perform the duties either of the position held at the time of the injury, if the application was submitted within 2 years, or within the last 90 days that the applicant performs services for the employer. And in that case, it's not the duties of the position, but it is the duties expected to be performed by the employer.
And how do these, what you're characterizing as substantive requirements, fit in with 353.01 subdivisions 4.1, which defines duty disability, and subdivision 4.4, which defines normal duties? How do they fit together?
Well, Your Honor, I think a good explanation of how they fit together is found in the Palermo case, which I cited in my brief. That talks about how you have to read all of these requirements together, and you kind of come out with three things. I mean, from the definition of duty disability, or regular disability, depending on what kind of disability you're dealing with, you have the requirement that this disability arose from, in the case of duty disability, the inherently dangerous duties of the position. Additionally, from that definition of duty disability, you get the requirement that the person has to be unable to perform those duties for at least a year. But that doesn't give you any indication of what time period you should be looking at. The time period that the PARA should be looking at comes from 353.031, which tells us, look at the job duties. If this application was submitted within 2 years of the injury, look at the job duties on the date of injury or the onset of the illness.
So, Ms. Robertson, if the ALJ didn't specifically come up with the date of the injury or the onset of the illness, in answer to my initial question, you thinking there was enough evidence in the record, it looks as if we'd have to send it back for that determination to be made to figure out which path, which legal path this should be analyzed under.
Your Honor, I respectfully submit that on this particular issue, the ALJ did make an explicit finding, not necessarily as to the specific date that this arose on, but we don't really need a specific date for the statute. It just has to be the question, is it more than 2 years or not? And her finding was, by a preponderance of the evidence, it is likely that he was suffering from PTSD in 2016. 2016 is well beyond 2 years before he submitted his application. He submitted his application in March of 2019. If his onset of his disability was before March of 2017, then we're looking outside of 2 years. And the question is, what were his duties 90 days beforehand? The ALJ did make that specific finding based on the testimony of the witnesses. And so I would submit that
Were the duties explicitly defined during that 90-day period? I don't have the order in front of me. Thank you.
And I should say the duties were explicitly defined both by a letter from the chief of police saying, here is going to be your assignment and here's the things you should not be doing. But also we brought in the testimony of his direct supervisor, Lieutenant Thomas Stiller, who went through all of the duties that he was expected to be performed and went through the list of the job description provided by Mr. Tichich in his para-duty disability application. He talked about each one and what respondent was actually expected to do in the traffic investigation unit. And so there is very good evidence in the record, and the ALJ made explicit findings about what Mr. Titch's duties actually were. And so I see I've got about 20 seconds left. So I'd just like to state that when you look at the statute, when you look at 353, that refers to both 353.01 and 353.031, all of these requirements, both the definition of duty disability and the procedural and substantive requirements of the application itself, have to be met before someone can be eligible for duty disability. And Mr. Titchish was not. Thank you.
And you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you for your argument. Next, we will hear from counsel for respondents. You may proceed. You have 15 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Ashley Bierman, and I represent respondent Thomas Tichich in the matter before you today. Your Honors, this is an appeal, and it is in front of you today because the appellant is unhappy with the determination made by the administrative law judge. The appellant feels that and felt that it has strong facts, and it believed that it should have won on those facts. However, they did not win on those facts. Therefore, as you know, the facts are not in front of your honors today. What is in front of your honors today is a proposal or an argument by the appellant to add requirements beyond what was contemplated by the legislature to the legal standard that determines whether a first responder is entitled to receive continuation of health insurance benefits following a career-ending injury. More specifically, the appellant is asking you to overturn the ALJ's decision in this case by adding additional criteria to the duty disability standard set forth in Minnesota Statute Section 353.656.
And so I'd like to ask the same question that I asked Ms. Robertson, and that is, how do these statutes fit together? And specifically, how does 353.031 subdivision 4, which provides some timing requirements and some procedures for the disability determination, how does that fit with the definition of duty disability and normal duties that we find in Section 353.01.
Absolutely, Your Honor. Minnesota Statute 353.031 sets forth the procedures that PARA, Public Employees Retirement Association, must follow when it's doing its initial determination with regard to whether a applicant, a member of their plan, is eligible to receive monetary benefits from that plan, specifically duty disability. So that statute does not go through and reference the legal criteria used in a Minnesota Statute 299A.465 contested case hearing, where the determination there is, does the individual meet the duty disability standard, the legal standard? Those are two very different things. So, Your Honor, when we're looking at 353.031, we're looking at what PARA, what the legislature is telling PARA to do during that initial review period in determining whether a member meets the duty disability standard for purposes of those monetary benefits. And so when we're looking at subdivision 4A and subdivision 4B, in practice, what this is indicating is PARA, you must serve certain forms and request certain information from the employers of the members in these cases. And that's what PARA did here, Your Honors. They submitted the forms that were required, asking Minneapolis very specific questions about the information that it is supposed to rely upon in awarding someone duty disability benefits. To be more specific, on in Mr. Titchich's case, I want to grab the actual dates for you. PARA sent a letter to Minneapolis on April 4th, 2019, and it asked really specific questions to Minneapolis, trying to get a handle on this exact issue, including...
And let's talk about that for a moment. So what your brief suggests that in a regular disability benefits determination, that the timing matters, right? 4A and 4B matter. Right. So you measure either against the 90 days, last 90 days of service, or you measure against the job, the duties in the job description, essentially the position duties, general position duties, depending on when the application is filed relative to the date of injury. Right.
Your Honor, the requirements set forth in the statute that we're talking about, Minnesota statute, and they're all very similar, so I like to go back to it, but 0.031, where we're talking about the procedures here, that is instructions to PARA on how they should proceed.
So right. Under subdivision 8 of 656, right? 656 sets the stand, says subdivision 1, it says basically, subdivision 1 says, you know, if you're determined to qualify under the definition that you find in 01 sub 41, then you're entitled to benefits. But we know that subdivision 8 says the procedures to determine it are in 031, right? That's how you get back to 031. Okay. And so there's a reason, even though if you looked at just subdivision 1 and you said, okay, well, what's the definition under 41? End of inquiry. And seems like you're saying the ALJ said end of inquiry under health insurance coverage. But I don't know why it also, that argument wouldn't also swallow this rule, end of inquiry in terms of disability benefits under subdivision 1 of 656. Except 656 says, no, go to the procedures. You have to measure against, you know, like under 4A and 4B. And so they ask for that information, not just as a procedural thing to do, but they're asking for it to actually make a substantive determination of what do we measure the person's capabilities against, right? I mean, the time frame matters and what you measured against matters, doesn't it? Otherwise, why are they asking for that anymore if all you have to do under subdivision 1 of 656 is look at the definition?
Your Honor, I think that I understand your question, but please correct me if I'm not answering this correctly. Subdivision 8 does make a reference to these procedures. I agree with you there. However, if we back this up to the statute that we're talking about here, what this contested case hearing, why this was even happening is Minnesota Statute 299A.465. And what that statute indicates if we just back it up to that, in subdivision 1A1 is that this subdivision with regard to this healthcare continuation benefit applies to any peace officer or firefighter who's eligible to receive a duty disability pursuant to section 353.656. And it ends there. In addition, if you continue reading, it does reference another statute which is applicable in the context of MSRS, Minnesota State Retirement Systems, and it says, comma, subdivision one. And I admit that it is a little bit unclear whether that subdivision one is supposed to apply to 353.656, but trying to draw on my law review days, I do believe that subdivision one would be in the context of both of those statutes and would be specifically referred to by the legislature with reference to Minnesota statute 299A.465.
What's the point of the statute? I mean, doesn't this kind of allow para to just jump and not, I mean, why have the statute? It seems to be irrelevant then if para isn't required to follow the procedures.
In this case, Your Honor, respectfully, para did follow the procedure. It requested this required information from the employer. And what this statute says underneath 4A and 4B is that the employer must, and the employer is required to, respond and provide certain types of information. In this case, Minneapolis chose not to provide a substantive response, giving para any information about the job duties that Mr. Tichich was performing in the 90 days preceding his disability from law enforcement.
And so is it your argument that they should have provided it not knowing? They said, we don't know when the date of injury was, because I don't think there was a first report of injury to the city, as far as I know.
There was the first report of injury to the city, Your Honor. And I do believe that it is a bit disingenuous for the city to indicate that it did not know.
Are you talking about the first diagnosis of PTSD in October 2017? What are you referring to? You're saying there is a first date of injury.
Your Honor, there was what's called a first report of injury filed with the city of Minneapolis. And that first report of injury was dated or provided an injury date of March 18th, 2018, I believe.
2018. I see it now.
Thank you. And so that is a form that is filled out directly within the city of Minneapolis. And that is also something that's required by PARA as a part of that application. So for Minneapolis to indicate that it had no idea why Mr. Tichich was filing this application, that's disingenuous at best. They had this first report of injury on file with the city. In addition, they did not ask for any additional information from PARA to assist them in providing that information. Instead, they chose to, and there was a lot of testimony about this, Your Honors, at the trial court level from Jody Cordes, who works for PARA and has worked there for, you know, 3 decades. She indicated that during that time frame, Minneapolis across the board was sending this form letter back, saying that it needed more information, and pushed that ball back essentially on PARA. It was not cooperating in providing this information about the job duties. So, Your Honors, it is absolutely my position that PARA followed what it needed to do in terms of making this initial duty disability determination under 353.031. Minneapolis, however, did not do what it was supposed to do, even though the statute specifically indicates the employer must provide. It chose not to participate. And because of that, they are now in a mess of its own making, in their own making. They are not
then. So I think that gets to, I don't know if the, and thank you for that information about the first report of injury. And that and that says that the date of the injury was whatever the March 2018 date that you're claiming. I wondered, I mean, as I understand your argument, I think, is that although the health insurance statute that we're under references 356 in its entirety, you're saying only subdivision one of 356 is relevant, and don't look at sub 8, which gets you into 0.031. And right?
Your Honor, I think even if you read it that way, so I would read it as referring only to subdivision one because it says comma subdivision one after it lists the two sections of the statute based on that plain language. If there's confusion there and we do need to look at subdivision eight, when we look at subdivision eight, I think that that is pretty clear in and of itself. So pulling up that language, the application procedures to determine eligibility for police and fire disability benefits are defined under 353, you know, and it says right there, application procedures, not additional criteria or additional requirements for this duty disability standard. This is
But you do agree, I think, that for the disability benefits that PARA would look at, depending on the application date and the date of injury, they might be looking at different duties, right?
PARA, in its initial determination for monetary benefits, may do that. That is not the case with Minnesota Statute 299A.465.
Okay. That's the key thing. So you're saying they may decide disability benefits and they may decide them based in one instance. I guess they might decide them based on what the last 90 days, service in the last 90 days, if they think 4B applies, right?
Absolutely.
But you're saying once it gets to the health insurance, leave that aside. What you look at is something else. You only look at a definition, which you, I think, are saying is only the position description.
Your Honor, I'm saying that we need to look at what the legislature said here in its plain language, and that is that we need to look at 656 or 56. I need to actually get the 656 statute, which references the duty disability definition in Minnesota Statutes 35301, Subdivision 41, and then the duties are defined in Subdivision 44. Which is the normal duties of the position.
And right. So my point is, I guess, in one case, the disability benefits decision, you might look at the last 90 days of service. And you're saying, no, under the health insurance, you would only look at the position description, I guess, right? Generically.
The normal duties as defined in that subdivision 44, yes, Your Honor.
No relevance to the actual applicant's. I mean, so that 90-day thing disappears entirely. So you could have a different decision on disability benefits in terms of whether you have a duty disability than under health insurance coverage.
You would never be at the point where you would be eligible to receive continuation of health care coverage unless there was an approval at the underlying level, the duty disability level by PARA. That is what starts this whole process. At that point, the employer is notified of their obligation to continue this coverage, and they have 60 days to appeal and get a de novo hearing in front of an ALJ in a contested case hearing setting.
Is it really, and I see your time is up. I'm going to have you answer this if you can. Is it really a de novo hearing if that underlying piece, the piece determined by PARA that triggered the entire thing, cannot be reviewed by the ALJ? How is that de novo?
Your Honor, I believe that the statute that we're talking about and what the legislature is indicating is that Minnesota Statute 353.031, duty disability or disability determination procedures, is exactly that. It is setting forth what the procedures are in this case for the parties involved. There is no review of that process, you're correct, because it is a de novo hearing. We're not looking at what PARA did or did not do when it made its initial determination to determine whether a member, such as Mr. Tichich, is eligible to receive monetary benefits, duty disability benefits. That's not a part of the analysis. What is the analysis is de novo. The ALJ gets to determine whether a member such as Mr. Tichich met the duty disability criteria, the legal standard. And that's set forth in a different part of the statute. And that is what the ALJ did in this case, Your Honors.
Okay. Thank you for your argument, Ms. Behrman. Are there any other questions of Ms. Behrman before we turn things back over to Ms. Robertson? Okay, thank you. And you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal, Ms. Robertson.
Thank you, Your Honors. So I just want to address the issue of kind of what the city of Minneapolis knew. The record shows that the city of Minneapolis did not receive any notification from Mr. Kitchich while he was employed there that he was suffering from any kind of disability. He never asked for accommodations, never brought up his disability with anyone. That's what the record shows. Additionally, it also shows that after he was already fired in December of 20, he fired March or April 2018. December 2018, they get a request from his attorney to do a first report of injury. Then in March of 2019 or April 2019, they get contacted by PARA saying, tell us, you know, about his disability, when it arose, what you did for him, certify all of these things. And the city, all the city knows is that he was saying that he was injured on March 18th, 2018, which is a Sunday, a day he was not working, and that he was requesting duty disability for some disability the city didn't know anything about. The city did not have the information that it needed to answer PARA's questions, which it told PARA. It doesn't have his medical records. It doesn't have the information it needed. It didn't even know that his PARA duty disability application was based upon this first report of injury, which is done for workers' comp claims. It's used in PARA cases. It has to be submitted. But the city had no way of knowing that this was the basis for his duty disability claim without confirmation from PARA, which they never received. Additionally, PARA doesn't ask for the correct information when it comes to the last 90 days of employment. If you look at the things requested by PARA, both from the applicant and from the employer, PARA just requests a position description for the last 90 days. They also request a position description for the at the time of injury, and they put it on the employer to figure out whether it was within 2 years or not. And Minneapolis simply didn't have the information. But also, if it was the last 90 days, the question is not a position description. The question is, what were the duties expected by the employer? So PARA shouldn't be asking for a position description. It should be asking for the duties expected by the employer, which is what's required by statute.
There we go. Can I ask you about that? So I'm trying... You know, the way the statute was previously before it was amended to add this definition talked about, you know, it had essentially the part of, you know, if you're disabled for 12 months from doing the duties, et cetera. And then it had the essentially what is now codified as a 4A and 4B requirements and so on. Then this definition was added. And as I understand sort of those, you know, the requirements, the 90 days versus the other one, it was a little bit, and maybe I'm wrong about this, and tell me if I'm wrong. If it's an older injury, you look at the 90 days of the duties that were actually expected of you. So it's sort of more the applicant's duties. The more current one, you look at the more generic position description duties, not specific to the applicant. But the definition, maybe that's wrong. Right. So tell me if I'm wrong. But the definition that's added, and that's why I want to hear, says job description and which the applicant forms on a day-to-day basis. I'm trying to figure out how those two things square with the continuation of the 4A and 4B provisions.
Well, the 4A and 4B provisions, I think the purpose of the 4A and 4B is that if you're, whether you're looking at someone with what I would call a fresh injury, who just decides that they can't keep working anymore because it's, you know, it hasn't been that long since they actually applied. Or someone with that had an injury that they've been working with for quite some time. Because you have to, you stop working, you have to apply within 18 months or you're out of luck. So, I mean, to say that 2 years, more than 2 years from the injury necessarily implies that the person kept working for a period of time. And so in that case, they have to show that, not that they weren't able to do the job they were doing, you know, 3 years ago, but if they got some light duty employment, if they got an accommodation from their employer, that they can no longer do that specific job. In this case, Mr. Kitchich was on a specific administrative light duty assignment. Now, it wasn't because of his disability, but the statute doesn't say it has to be because of the disability. That's just what he was doing. He was capable of doing it. And he continued to do it for many, many months before he was fired, not because of a disability, but because of a felony conviction. So that's where we are with Mr. Tichich, and that's how the statute applies, in my opinion, in this case. So thank you.
Thank you very much.